4, 5, 6.
Thank you, George. Think of all the frequent flyer miles I got. You know, there's always a positive side to this, right? If this gets in anybody's way, let me know, because I'm practically certain it's going to get in mine. If you see me edging where it's going to crash, signal me, will you? Appreciate that. That's known as issue anticipation, and that's what we're here to talk about. My message actually is pretty simple and straightforward, and I don't want you to think that I or anybody has a corner on how to deal with issues. But there are some things that those of us who do this professionally, and I want to emphasize that point, because if you're going to deal with issues, the only way to do it is the way I do professionally. You see, and that is I come in and you tell me all about your issue and I tell you everything to do, and then, heck, I go on somewhere else and you got to live with it and put out the fires, you see. But in about 35 years of dealing with issues professionally all over the country, personally, and a lot of colleagues in our own firm and others who do it, there are some basics that we fairly well agree upon. And let me just emphasize these three basic lessons that we've learned in dealing with all kinds of issues, including a great number of school issues. The first is that running an organization or a society by crisis is clearly not the way to do it. And it can be very damaging. And yet, if you look at American society, the very democratic principles that made us a separate national entity virtually cry out for us to manage the situation by crisis. And if you look at American history or look at contemporary America, I don't think many of you would disagree that when we finally make a decision on something, it's because there's a crisis. So right off, we know we've got a problem. It's not the way to do things. That doesn't mean we shouldn't have great debate and all of that, but does everything have to become an explosive crisis before we do something about it? Not a system that makes it easy to be an administrator, clearly, as you all could spend hours telling me. And so the second part of what I want to say is that I believe a primary role of the contemporary manager's skill basket, toolkit, call it what you will, has to be learning how to get ahead of issues before they become crisis. We live in a society, in other words, where this is the way we do things, and so an administrator has to look at this realistically and say, not much I can do about that, there it is, but I am going to learn how to get ahead of these issues so that they're not always going to keep my district in a state of crisis, because that is damaging, that is not the way to do things. The interesting thing about learning how to get ahead of issues, how to avoid crisis, is that not only is it a good damage control technique, saves tons of time and money, but interestingly enough, it also lets you capitalize on the one or two positive sides of issues and crisis. And believe it or not, there are some positives. And I will try to enunciate those as clearly as I can. And pardon me if I cough. One of my other problems was I got sat next to a smoker, and I'm not very good at that. First question, what's an issue, what's a crisis?
Well,
that's a crisis.
That's a crisis.
I don't even know who's doing this recording, but I'll try and comply. An issue is something that has three characteristics that we need to be aware of. First of all, obviously, there's a pretty important disagreement going on. People are in disagreement over something. But we're in disagreement all the time. So how do you characterize then an issue? When is it something worth worrying about getting ahead of? Well, the primary thing about an issue that's worth worrying about is that it has to affect many people. If you've got a problem among your first grade teachers, it can be a major disagreement, but you probably don't have enough first grade teachers or enough fallout from that, that is the kind of issue I'm talking about. That's the sort of thing you're used to resolving in your typical managerial methodologies of small group practice. But if an issue really affects a lot of people, and if it is emotional, if it's gotten to that point where, boy, it turns them on or off, now you've got the kind of issue that I'm talking about. Those are the kind of issues to look out for because, of course, this and this makes it explosive. A crisis, by contrast, is not just an issue. You can be dealing with, goodness, hundreds of issues, as you all know, simultaneously, and none of them may become crises. But you know that it's a crisis when one other thing happens. Crisis has all of those ingredients. But a crisis is so emotionally charged or so concerned with the basic details of some topic that things won't be the same again. In other words, it's seen by the people involved, rightly or wrongly, as a turning point, as a watershed. Now things are going to be different, and we're really going to never go back to the old ways. Of course, crises, therefore, are issues that got out of hand. So the question before us is, excuse me, how to determine issues and then how to keep them from becoming crises. Of course, everyone wants a pill, an overnight fix for this situation. And I don't have one. Excuse me. What I do have, though, is a system that many of us working together have developed. And that's what I want to share with you because I think you might be able to apply it in your own administrative situation. If we know the difference between an issue and a crisis, then we need to ask ourselves, okay, how do we see them coming? How can we anticipate issues? Because that's really the heart, excuse me, of dealing with issues and crises, is that single word, anticipation. The funny thing is that though you may not have thought of yourself in this way, there isn't a person in this room that isn't a pretty good issue anticipator. You do it all the time, but you do it in a sort of a natural way. How many times do you get in a discussion and you say, boy, you know, in a couple of years, we could have a problem with that. Or did you see what they did over in Jonesville? I think that could really come to be a problem for us. Well, that's issue anticipation in the way we typically do it, but that's the problem. We talk about it, we kick it around, we bemoan the situation or whatever. But we don't systematically take a look at issues as they're coming down the pike and then apply some methodology to deal with them before they, in fact, become the kind of issues that can be harmful. The first thing we've learned, those of us who do this professionally, is to try and get a time frame on an issue. Because if you and I were to share here the issues you're dealing with, and maybe we'll do that in a minute, let's face it, the list would be a mile long. Well, it's nice to anticipate issues, but I understand you have one or two other things to do besides. And so clearly issue anticipation, though I think it's a critical part of your toolkit, isn't the whole kit. And so we've got to get it into manageable segments. And the way that we have traditionally done that is to say that there are four levels of issues. And this four levels might also be called four time frames of issues. The first kind of issues are latent issues. Can you see that pale blue, that turquoise? Okay. I have a soft spot in my heart for New Mexico, so I kind of wanted to use that color. It's a good seaside color, isn't it? A latent issue is something that maybe a scholar somewhere, maybe an activist, maybe a small group of parents are talking about, and you know they're talking about it. Maybe somebody has written an article in a journal or a small magazine, and so you know it's there, and if you look at it, you say, you know, that could be troublesome. That makes some sense. But the fact is, at the moment, it's just a couple of people over talking to themselves in a corner somewhere, and it isn't really picking up any momentum. Right there, when you spot an issue that rationality and experience tells you, hey, this one, you know, if it ever came to anything, this could be dangerous. As soon as you say those words to yourself, bang, jump on that issue right away, because now, more than at any other time, you have a chance to really deal with that issue and maybe stop it from arising. Right there is the time to catch them. When we do this for large national organizations, we have people reading all the little magazines and all the things that are put out by the sociology department at this university and the journal of this professional society, because that's where you find, on this big national basis, these kind of latent issues. There are other ways for you to find them in your district, and we'll talk about that later. But that's the first kind of issue. It's way off, probably. Occasionally, there'll be a latent issue that will just come to fire like that. But frankly, I have a hard time even thinking of an example in the years that I, at least, have been dealing with issues. The trouble with latent issues is that the kind of people who cook them up are usually zealots, or they feel pretty strongly about them, or even if they're just nice, ordinary people like you and me, they feel a sense of ownership in this issue, this latent issue. So they say, hey, I think that's important. I want to push that out into society. And as they start doing that, the latent issue now becomes an emerging issue. Now, an emerging issue is the kind of thing that if you went out and did some research in your district to find out whether people were concerned about this, you'd find a very small number concerned, you know, maybe 8%, maybe 2%, maybe 15% at the most. But that's a lot different than two people talking about it in a corner. That means that issue is starting to emerge. Now, the National Opinion Research Center, NORC, at the University of Chicago, this is that group that every year publishes that awful directory that tells us how Americans feel about various institutions or professionals. You know, they tell us we don't like car salesmen and we like ministers and we're not sure about doctors and we like clergymen. That group, well, they sort of are the great repository for public opinion studies in this country. And they recently did something that I think tells us how important emerging issues are. A group there took all of the research that they could find on public issues from 1939 to 1979. That was like a five-year project to just go through that material. And when they were through the material, they discovered that if an issue moves 20 points on the scale of public opinion, that it is inevitably a major issue. And most of the time, if it moves up that 20 points in a period of, say, a year or two, whatever it is that's being promoted is inevitable social policy. So if we were to go out in your district and find that 15, 16% of the people felt that this issue was important, you see how close we are now to an explosive situation. When an issue is not dealt with here or here, because those are the two opportunities, then we have what we call a hot issue. It's in current public debate. You've got to deal with it. As soon as an issue gets there, you have lost. And the reason you have lost is just very simple and basic psychology. In a democratic society, how do you resolve issue debates when they're really public debates? Well, there's only one way to resolve them in our society, and that is with some kind of a compromise, some kind of an accommodation. And so that's why I say you've lost as soon as it becomes a hot issue, because you've got to give up something that you might not otherwise have done. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. And let's face it, sometimes those people out there raising the issues may in fact have a lot to say. They may have a pretty good case. Maybe we should have listened to them before it became an issue. But that's another subject, and that's really a question of your judgment in administering your particular school. The fact of the matter is that if a hot issue occurs to you, you better be prepared with some kind of a fallback plan. Whenever we deal with an issue, one of the first things we do is to draw up a fallback plan. Because if it ever gets to hot current debate, you're going to have to trade off something. And the longer that you have to think about what you're willing to trade off, and the longer you're willing and able to involve other people who will be involved in that trade-off, the better your chances of making the trade, solving the issue debate, and not getting in a lot of hot water back home or with other constituencies that you have to stay in good standing with. Now, for a long time, this guy's going to be disappointed, but in a minute I'm going to give up on this. For a long time, we thought that once you solved a hot issue, it was all over. Wow, you know, thank goodness, we got rid of that one. We got through the school bond question, the school finance question, or, you know, gee whiz, we got the textbook dispute settled. But because of the nature of hot issues, where you have to make accommodations to settle them, we've learned in the last few years, unhappily, that there's a fourth category of issues, and they may be the most dangerous of all, and those we call fallout issues. And what we mean is that when the hot issue was settled, some of the little pieces that we kind of shoved aside as accommodations or just to get them out of there so we could settle a hot issue, of course, they're still kind of burning over here in the corner, and their partisans pick them up, and they can make them hot issues immediately. They don't have to go back through latent and emerging state because they already were part of the discussion of the previous issue. And so when we do get into a situation where we have an issue that's hot, we have to deal with it, we have a fallback plan, we're going to make some accommodations, it's inevitable. You know, nobody ever wins 100% of anything. So you make those accommodations, then we've got to be very careful what we choose to compromise on, because you are looking in the face your next hot issue if you don't be very careful about the fallout. Now, how does this all translate down to something you might think about using? I'm going to put it into a system for you later, a system that we use, which may be helpful to you, may not be helpful to you at all, but at least you'll see it fitting together. For the moment, the point I want to make here is that if we just look at issues as issues, and we think they're all very similar, we're not going to be able to manage them very well. We really need some kind of a method like this. Now, you may want to devise a different method, but I'm merely suggesting that we need some kind of a method in order to really deal with these issues. The question then that we have to ask is, where do issues come from? What really is the basis for any of these issues coming at us in the first place? Well, there's one word that really describes that better than anything I can think of, and that word is change. Issues, in one way or another, arise from change. Sometimes they come from our changing environment, our changing society, all of those changes that we're so accustomed to, but others come from a different kind of change, which is the unexpected. The unexpected. That is, after all, a change. People see it as a change. A lot of the school issues that are happening today are coming from this unexpectedness. People for years took the schools for granted. We all know that. And then when suddenly we got the spotlight again, we got it in a negative way with a lot of critical reports. Well, you see, that was a change, an unexpectedness that these people, it just shocked them. And so immediately, there are issues around education that weren't there. They were latent or emerging. We didn't apparently hear them as an educational body. And so suddenly, they're with us. Now, the thing you have to remember about change is that, well, there are really three points about change. The first is that Americans are not as averse to change as we sometimes think. Oh, listen, nobody likes a change that affects your own lifestyle. But Americans love change that affects other people. I mean, this is one of the great American sports in this country, is to bring about changes that will sock the other guy, but won't touch me. So you see, already Americans love the idea of change. There's no other country in the world where people are trying to change things all the time. But if you look carefully, of course, you find very few change agents who are willing to make a little sacrifice of their own to get the change made. It's always that somebody else should do something different. The point being that change really is accepted by Americans a lot more than we sometimes think. As a matter of fact, there's a decennial study of the basic. There's a couple of chairs up here if you're willing to. Okay. There's a decennial study of the really basic beliefs of Americans. And when the study was done for the 1980s, for the first time, it showed that Americans know, they truly understand that change is a perpetual thing. This is the first time. It took the last 10 years to get them to this point. In fact, this has now gotten a little out of hand. in some ways. And you ought to think very seriously about this, because it's where maybe some of your issues arise in a funny way. Americans are now so accustomed to change that when we counsel, say, a manufacturer of a product, say we were counseling a company that made this kind of stuff, today, if they don't change this thing every 2 or 3 years, their business goes to pot. They have to change what it's made of, they have to change the packaging, they have to do something, because if they don't do it, everybody thinks it's old-fashioned. It's, you know, gosh, it's not keeping up. So that Americans actually are looking for pretty perpetual change. And that's a point we need to remember. And if you think about the schools for a minute, we were taken for granted for this long period of time. And it was kind of comfortable because everybody wasn't all over us the way they've been the last decade. But think now what was happening during that period when schools were taken for granted. You see, we weren't making any changes. And society was changing. And society demands some kind of change, and suddenly the schools look pretty old hat, not keeping up. And when we do research in specific school districts, and we don't do your typical kind of polling, you know, 23% for and 42% against or that kind of stuff, we find that not very useful if you're really trying to get at what motivates people. And so we do some sociological and psychological and even some anthropological types of research. And when you ask people the basic question about education, which is, has the job of the schools changed in the last 10, 20, 25 years? The great majority of people in every district we've ever done this in say, why no? They still should be doing this. You know, the only job they have is the same job they had when I was in school, says someone who may be 20, who may be 80. Well, of course, you and I know that the body of knowledge, what we know about human life in that period of 20 years, has increased by a factor of 4. And if you're not aware of it, what we know about the world in which we live now doubles every 6.5 years. Well, somehow, maybe we should have been getting that out there to these people, you see, because suddenly they think, gee, everything's the way it was when I was in school, whenever they were in school, whether they got out last year, whether they got out 50 years ago. And so from that kind of change comes the kind of issues that we're dealing with today. Now, there are two kinds of change. And I want to go into this just a little bit, because I do want to give you some background. I want you to know that the system that we use didn't just kind of spring into our minds one day when we had a problem, when we're trying to solve it. There's some pretty substantive data behind this. There are two kinds of change. First, there are structural changes. For example, the fact that the United States is moving towards a service economy, jobs in the service, information sector, that kind of thing, and away from an industrial economy is a structural change. It is not going to be reversed. And that's the key skill, I guess I can call it a skill, for you as administrators. In your district, are you and your staff, your advisors, able to look at change and know when it's structural, when it isn't going to change? In Oregon, is the timber industry ever going to be the big industry again? What is agriculture up to? Is the Pacific Rim the future? I don't know, but those are structural changes. And someone who can get a handle on that in their own community now has something they can really deal with. The other kind of change is cyclical change. And in the schools, there's really no institution in our society that is so much at the mercy of cyclical change, of course, than schools. Gosh, how long ago was it that that we were talking about we had too many teachers and we didn't know what to do with them, and now we're projecting a teacher shortage, and we were closing schools, and now in a lot of communities we're opening schools, and all of this cyclical kind of business. So if we know that the change comes in a structural fashion and a cyclical fashion, and that it will emerge as an issue in one of those four ways, now we've got a fairly good background. Now we can start managing those issues. And the best way to start managing them is to know what the life cycle of an issue is, because issues, in fact, do have a very definite life cycle. They start with change, as we've said. And then the first step in their life cycle is, of course, that they emerge, never mind going through all that again. But when they start to emerge, an interesting thing happens. It's kind of like, you know, writing a tune, let's say. Say you're a composer and you write a tune. Once you release that tune out into the world, people can whistle it any way they want to. You can't anymore, you know, you can say, this is the way I wrote it, this is what I want you to do with it. But once it's out there, hey, it's their tune, and they're going to embellish it and do all their things with it. Well, the same is true of issues. You and I may cook up an issue, and we may take it through the latent stage and build it into an emerging issue. But once it truly emerges, then the great public takes that issue and shapes it to fit its desires. And so what happens is that we see a defining of the issue. After the issue is defined, or while it's being defined, the next step is the issue is named. And right in those two areas, if you're doing issue anticipation, is an opportunity to really command and control what's happening. Because any of you who are old debaters know that he or she who defines the issue decides who's going to win and lose right at the beginning. And even better, he or she who names that issue has an even more powerful tool, because the great majority of people in your district will never get down into this much detail. They'll only learn the buzzwords that describe the issue to people so they can quickly zip it off their tongue. Is it possible to be enough ahead of issues that we can help define them? Yes, it is. Particularly if, when we see an emerging issue, or better yet, a latent issue, if we take command of it, start talking it up among our people, doing maybe what we have to do. If there's some logic in this, if it's a criticism, let's say, if it's a critical issue, and it's something that really maybe we ought to learn from, obviously, if we can do things ahead of the issue to just make it disappear, that's best. But issues aren't often that simple, as we know. So the second best thing we can do is we will define what the issue is. We will set the parameters of discussion by defining that issue. Now, politicians are good at this. They know how to set the tone of the debate, and that right there makes a big determination of how that debate is going to come out. Even more important is to name the issue. I cannot overemphasize the importance of that semantic capability. I can tell you some stories about that and how important it is, maybe, that will help to implant in your minds how people really deal with these kind of subjects, and it is indeed based on their name. Some of you may have heard me explain before that one of our clients is the American agricultural industry meeting as a coalition. It's not a fun group to meet with anymore. But we do counsel them on a number of issues. And one of the issues we've been dealing with over the last 10 years is the issue of the treatment of animals. The farmers, animal farmers at least, obviously are committed to the use of animal flesh, of animal byproducts, manipulating animal life, if you will, for the benefit of human society. It's been going on a rather long time, something like 50 million years, say the Leakeys in their African studies. And the farmers, of course, continue this way of life. What they're concerned about is the welfare of their animals. Now, there are a group of people, some vegetarians, some concerned people about animals, who think that maybe we shouldn't manipulate animals in this way, that they should not be used for the benefit of humans, but should in fact be allowed to live their own lives. And so that's how the issue is joined. Those are the disagreements. Well, what do we do? For our client, since the farmers were truly concerned with the welfare of their animals, as a farmer always, as I used to say, at least in the old days, you don't kick your horse. You know, I mean, you just don't kick your horse, because your horse pulls your plow and does all these things. You may get mad as anything, so you throw your hat on the ground or you swear or something, but don't kick your horse. That's what they're concerned about, is the welfare of these animals they're raising. So they call their group the Farm Animal Welfare Coalition. Now, this then forced the people who were questioning the use of animals to call themselves the Animal Rights coalition. And I submit to you that as soon as those names were selected, though this thing is rolling out and it'll probably become a debate in America, I suggest to you that probably that encapsulates the feeling of most Americans. Given the choice between farmers who've been with us forever and who treat their animals in a good way with looking out for the welfare of the animals on the one hand, and a group who thinks animals ought to have civil rights on the other, how do you think that debate is going to turn out? Well, I can tell you right now, while they're lining up to get a big mad, they're going to think about animal welfare. Now, you may be on the other side of that issue, but it's just an illustration of how important that is. Never forget that wonderful story of Dickie Nixon's. Dickie, despite his rehabilitation, his downfall, his rehabilitation, the ups and downs of Tricky Dickie, the fact of the matter is, say those who worked with him, and I have to tell you that we counseled him in the 19 in his first attempt to win the presidency when he lost. I maybe shouldn't tell you that. He lost when we counseled him. But whatever else you say about him, he was a very far-seeing person. You know, after all, can you imagine any other president that would propose a guaranteed annual wage to get rid of the welfare problem? Well, Nixon did that and worked very hard on it for 4 years. That still would be an explosive suggestion in Washington today, and he did that way back when he was president. Well, he saw that it was clear the United States was going to have to take into account China. After the Korean War and all the things in the Far East, he said, look, you know, with all those people there, for us to just say that they're bad guys and leave them alone is just ignorance. It's ostrich approach. So he said, I want to have a meeting with the Chinese. I want to break the door open to meet with the Chinese. So here's what he did. All through his campaigns, he had spoken about the godless communists in China. That was his standard phrase, the godless communists in China. And on one Friday, he went to San Francisco. He spoke to the San Francisco World Affairs Council. And in that speech, for the first time, he called China the People's Republic of China. And on Monday morning, the White House got a call from Chou En-lai with a simple message: when, Mr. President, would you like to meet? You can read all about this in Nixon's books and in Kissinger's and others' books, but the simple fact was that by calling them what they called themselves, by giving them that respect, it signaled this total change. And as you know, about 6 months later, they did meet and opened up at least the beginning of American relations with China. So this whole business of semantics is critical, and it's something that we can do. Now, the reason it's important to do it there is that the next thing that happens is the issue picks up a champion. Now, sometimes that champion is a person you don't have to worry about. Maybe it's a zealot on this issue. Maybe it's a person that just doesn't have a following or isn't reputed to be one that knows a lot about how you do these things. But maybe it's one or a number of people who have got some clout and who are opinion leaders. Well, how it's defined and how it's named has a great influence on who's willing to pick it up as a champion. It's a rare issue that begins with a group of folks who then also become the champions. Usually they have to look outside. The people who start an issue have to look outside and find someone who's already extremely well plugged in with the community and get that person or persons to become their champions. The next thing that happens, of course, is that a group forms around the issue. The next step, of course, is that they go to the media and the politicians and the luncheon club circuit, etc., to try and take their issue and either, if it's a latent issue, make it emerge. If it's an emerging issue, make it hot. And the next step is that some kind of what I will call legislation, although it may not in fact be true legislation, regulation, social policy change, is suggested. Now, there's a lot more steps before a group successfully brings us to new legislation. But that's the life cycle when we have a chance, excuse me, to do something about that issue. Once it gets past that first legislative attempt, that social policy change or whatever it is, it's an awful lot harder to deal with. Up here, as you can see, we can have a real influence. But notice the one prerequisite. We've got to be following these issues, we've got to be anticipating them, and dealing with them once we find out what they are. That's part of the system. The next part of the decision that you have to make is whether this issue, and this is also true of crises, whether this issue is going to affect you sooner or later. And we have a little rule on that. Any issue that doesn't look like it's going to really mature in 1 to 3 years, don't waste your time on. Because by the time you do a lot of thinking about it, the issue will change 3 times and society will change 2x. So concentrate on issues that are apt to be close at hand, or if they're latent issues, because you can put them out. So it's important to keep a time frame that makes some sense. And the reason I mention that is that you'll read a lot of articles and books even on people who would have all of you administrators sort of become crystal ball gazers and futurists. You've all read those articles. You know, boy, we're looking out to what's going to be like in 2005. Hey, do we really care? I'd kind of like to get through 90 myself. I'd feel pretty good about that. And so let's look for those issues that are going to be here and now that we can really put some energy into and get some payoff back. And don't get trapped in this business of looking way down the pike, unless you know you haven't got anything else to do on Saturday afternoon or something like that. But now, how do you respond to all of this? This is the background, if you will. We're going to look for short-term stuff. We know that it's going to go through some kind of a cycle like this. We know that it comes from change, and it is going to be identified in one of those categories. Now, how do you deal with it? What's the system for dealing with it? Well, let me switch for a minute and talk, if I may, about issues that got out of hand, about crises. We didn't do all this, because it may help to illuminate also the system for dealing with issues in their anticipatory phase. There are 5 types of crises, 5 types of things that really get you in the soup now. The first category come from an accident, a true accident. I mean, it really was an accident. Those are usually not all that hard to deal with if you do a couple of things. The rules are simple for accident crisis. One is to absolutely, first, foremost, before you do anything else, express supreme concern for the victims, even if all they lost was their wallet. It never hurts to really be concerned and to express it. And I can't tell you how often we don't do that. We're thinking about, you know, what's the next step? Is everybody going to be mad? And so we let that wonderful human opportunity go by. And we try to deal with an accident issue to the point where, truly, if someone comes and says, well, you had this accident, or you had this bus accident, and what are you going to do about that? And we like to have the kind of response where we say, wait a minute. You know, first, we're concerned about the people who were involved, who may have been hurt. Let's talk about them first. You know, never mind what are we going to do about it and who's responsible and all those games that people want to play. We're concerned. This has a wonderfully diffusing effect because it brings it to that level of human concern where you can handle it. As soon as you let anybody get into the business of who's responsible, who screwed up, you know, who are we going to blame for this? Well, of course, you're in deep trouble, as all of you, I'm sure, know very well. But after you've expressed concern in an accident kind of a crisis, then you do have to follow that by showing, what are you going to do about it? We're really concerned, you know, we're sorry that these poor people had this problem, whatever it is. And here's the steps we're taking to see that it doesn't recur. Relatively easy to deal with, usually. The second category may not be as easy. And those are those wonderful crises or issues that come out of scandal. All the defense contractors right now are getting this very lecture from their public relations vice presidents. What do you do in the case of a scandal here? And what you do is this. Most scandals involve individuals, not the whole organization. There are scandals that involve organizations. Clearly, if there's a conspiracy through the organization, or if two or three people within an organization are doing something. Certainly some of the brokerage houses during the Wall Street scandals were looking fairly bad, because if you lined up the number of people involved in some of those deals, they all worked in the same place, and it almost looked like it was institutional. But the fact of the matter is that in a scandal situation, usually the goal is to distance the organization, because the scandal generally will involve a person or two persons. Very often, you can distance the organization and point out that it is the individuals. Now, the danger here is that the immediate human idea usually is to make somebody a scapegoat. See, so right away you want to get rid of it by scapegoating this. I've got one of these going on right now in the Northeast. As I'm sure you know, the interstate banking laws are changing, and soon we're going to be like Canada and have about six banks all across the country, say some pundits. I'm not sure I agree with that. But in any event, one of our large bank clients had a person on staff who got a little overzealous in this business of having one big bank, and he was going out and buying the stock in all the other banks, and pretty soon it turned out that this rather large bank inadvertently owned about 20 other banks, totally in contravention of the law. At least they owned more of the stock than is legally allowed. Well, of course, the chairman right away, you know, wants to run this guy out on the limb and then let everybody spotlight and saw it off and scapegoat this person. Is that a good policy or is it not? Generally, it has a lot of dangers. And one of the dangers is that that person may then pick up a lot of underdog sympathy. And people say, holy Moses, I think it's that whole outfit, and they're just making John here the scapegoat for what really happened. And there are other times, frankly, in this particular case, I think John did do it all by himself, so maybe we'll scapegoat him. But the point is to distance the organization in a scandalous issue. The third kind of issue are relatively similar to scandals, and those we call bedfellow issues. In other words, someone on your board, let's say, is involved in an issue somewhere else, or takes a political stand on something else, and yet somehow, because that person is on your school board, or maybe is a teacher in your school, or a staff person, you know how you have a way of getting dragged into it somehow, or at least the whispering going on says, well, you know, he works at the school, as if somehow that had something to do with it. Well, in the great American public mind, yeah, it does have something to do with it. It's totally irrational, but then, I mean, the American public is totally irrational, we all know that, and so what do you do? Well, again, we can try and distance ourselves from this bad actor, if that's the case. But the danger here is not scapegoating so much, because after all, you're not involved, but is to make a statement about that person's judgment. In other words, if you come out and start criticizing this person, it's just as bad as scapegoating them. Very often then they get this underdog support and people say, gosh, you know, you'd think at least they might say some kind words along with whatever the criticisms are. Well, those are the ones that are relatively easy to deal with, and there's a fourth kind that you're so used to that you probably don't even need me to talk about it, and that is the ones that are simple disagreements. You've got a certain view of how a curriculum ought to be run, and by golly, there's this group of parents, and they have another idea of how the curriculum ought to be run. The danger here, the danger in disagreements, is to say, well, after all, we're the school system, and we know how to do this. You see, and it's really kind of un-American. These people are sort of commies, you know, they're pinkos or whatever. This happens a lot more than you might want to imagine, but the fact of the matter is that the only statement that can be made in a disagreement to give us one up is to say we have a disagreement on this, but the great thing about the American system is that everybody can stand up and say how they feel, and we're glad they stood up and called it to our attention, and we're listening to them. We ain't going to change anything, maybe, but we're listening, we're in a debate. If you switch the focus to the great American system that allows people to be involved, this helps.